This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the record of Master Bodhidharma, his breakthrough sermon. A student asked, if someone is determined to reach enlightenment, what is the most essential method they can practice? And Bodhidharma said, the most essential method, which includes all other methods, is beholding the mind. Sometimes when you're really worried about something, a good way to practice it is to imagine, step into the worst thing that can happen and make your peace with that. Because it might happen. The most essential method is beholding the mind. Said that Bodhidharma taught that Zen is a special transmission that can't be conveyed through scriptures, that is not held within words and phrases, that it is a direct pointing to the mind and the realization of enlightenment. We also speak of mind training. Sesshin is said to mean gathering the mind. We sit and turn towards the mind. We speak of calming the mind, examining, investigating the mind, direct pointing to the mind. Many ways of speaking about beholding the mind. Beholding is a nice, kind of a nice word. Embracing, holding all of it. Buddhism is spoken of as the path that, in which we cease from creation of harm, knowing how we can create destruction, to practice good so that, and good for others, so that we understand from the beginning that it's not just about self comfort, self liberation, and to study and realize the mind. And so from the very beginning, it's made clear that there's a direct relationship, an integrated path between your mind and your happiness and the happiness of others. Bodhidharma said that the mind is the root from which all things grow. And if you can understand the mind, everything is included here. It's like the root of a tree. All a tree's fruits and flowers, branches and leaves depend on its root. If you nourish its root, the tree multiplies. If you cut its root, it dies. Those who understand the mind reach enlightenment with minimal effort. Those who don't understand the mind practice in vain. Everything good and bad comes from your own mind. To find something outside of this mind is not possible. And if we look at that teaching in terms of the samsaric mind, it's the root from which all things, all grievances, all distress, all conflicts arise. Everything that is harmful, everything that is suffering is included in this samsaric mind. It's like the root of a tree. The root is the basis, the tree, the fruit, the flowers, the branches, leaves, all depend on the samsaric mind. The Buddha called it delusion. And if you nourish that root, that delusion, with more delusion, then the tree multiplies. It gets larger. The fruit of that tree ripens. But if you cut off the root, it dies. If delusion is realized as enlightenment, then the tree withers, that tree of samsara. The enlightened mind is the root from which all things grow. If we understand this mind, we realize it encompasses everything, including samsara. It's like the root of a tree. All things, the tree, the fruit, the flowers, the branches, the leaves, all spring forth from this enlightened mind, this Buddha mind. If you nourish the root, everything flourishes. But if you don't nourish it, then the tree begins to wither. Those who understand the mind reach, this enlightened mind reach enlightenment with minimal effort. So one way we could look at that is that our struggle, you know, is not just a random occurrence. It's causal. It's based in karma and conditions, which means that when we're struggling, we're not just struggling sort of independently of other things, that we're struggling because there's something in that moment that is not clear, that we're not in contact with, that we're not able to bring forth, maybe that we understand but we're not able to engage. And so it's a different way of looking at struggle, that a struggle is just a bummer. You know, a struggle is just something that sucks and you want it to stop. Rather than seeing whatever we consider a struggle as a sign. It's a sign that something is not yet clear. And so we're here to make things clear. So in that way, that struggle is helping to bring our attention closer. And so we speak of the three poisons or the afflictions, greed, anger, and delusion. Jealousy and pride are also included. And of course, you can make up your own extended list. But the greed, anger, and delusion are the sort of the principal roots of that tree, that samsaric tree. And so greed sort of encompasses everything in the realm of grasping. Anger encompasses everything in the realm of aversion. So one is moving towards to try and cling to, and the other is moving away from, trying to avoid. And delusion really encompasses the whole. And so Bodhidharma says they're like rivers that surge for 1,000 miles because the constant flow of small springs. And so it's like in Sesshin and sitting, one moment after moment, just these little springs appear. And then what we're trying to do is learn how to skillfully meet each of those springs, but ultimately realize that they're all coming from one source. We call that delusion. We call that the illusion of the self. The illusion of the self as being who we are, as being something fixed. And so we have to see all of those expressions of the afflictions. Because if we don't see them, we don't practice them. If we don't practice them, they don't shift. And Bodhidharma says we should turn the three poisons into the three pure precepts. That we turn the six thieves. The thieves are the portals through which the world pours in and the self pours out. And they mingle and create karma. And the consciousness within each of those portals, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. And so that the six thieves, and they're called thieves because they steal away our attention, our compassion, our understanding, our patience, our courage. You know, we could think of mindfulness rather than in addition to being the beginning of our concentration, that when we're mindful, which is to be able to keep your attention on one thing in a moment. That when we're mindful, we're not turning away. When we're not mindful, we're turning away. So in that way, it's not just a matter of developing concentration, but it's actually continuing to turn towards, stay with one true thing. And so the six thieves are the ways in which we get stolen away. We steal ourselves away. And those should be transformed into the six paramitas, the vehicles of the bodhisattva. And Bodhidharma is saying that we do that by beholding the mind, by direct pointing. And the important thing is to know that this isn't just, he's not just talking about sitting in Zazen, doing meditation. You know, we're so conditioned to think of, you know, it's like, what's his name? Cogito ergo sum, the reductionist, the philosopher, that everything is reducible, right? That we are nothing but machines, and we're reducible to our individual parts, and if we just understand the parts, then one will understand the whole. Right. Perhaps one of the most dangerous additions to human belief. And so we can see, think of Zazen that way, we can think of practice that way, and there's a lot that seems to support that. It's a path, there's instruction, there's sort of a lot of ways in which Buddhism, particularly early Buddhism, is presented that seems to follow a linear path. Do this. This is how it's going to develop. This is what's going to happen. And it's not that there isn't some truth to that, but it clicks into that way of thinking, which is linear and kind of machine-like. And so we do Zazen, and we're going to get something, an experience. And when we get certain experiences, we want to grab onto them because this is what we're practicing for. This is the production of the machine. Right? You put something in, an experience pops out. You don't want to lose it, right? And what happens is that our Zazen and practice and ourselves and the world becomes machine-like. And it's not that. And this is really what Bodhidharma is pointing to. Beholding the mind. Beholding the mind is not just a posture. It's not just Zazen, unless we understand posture in the largest possible sense. Unless we understand Zazen in the largest possible sense. Largest in the sense of boundless, limitless. And it includes this very body and mind of thought and words and actions and creatures and motion and time and space. Why Dogen says in Fukasa Zengi, he says, the Zazen I speak of is not meditation practice. Don't think of it that way. It's too small. It is simply the Dharma gate of ease and joy, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. Before we realize it, after we realize it, without realizing it. It is the koan realized. Traps and snares can never reach it. Dogen says the moon reflected in the puddle does not disturb the water. The water is not disturbed by the moon. If you grasp this point, you're like a dragon entering the water, like a tiger in the mountains. The student asked Bodhidharma, and says, but the Buddha said, only after undergoing innumerable hardships for three asamkhya kalpas did I achieve enlightenment. This is the Buddha speaking. So the student says, why do you now say that simply beholding the mind and overcoming the three poisons is liberation? An Asamkhya Kalpa is a very, very, very long time, during which there are thousands and thousands and thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of practices that are being undergone. It's not just time waiting. It is very, very engaged. It's an immeasurably long period of time. And so he's saying, the Buddha said that he had to undergo three innumerable hardships in three of these immeasurably long periods of time. And you say simply beholding the mind is liberation. Bodhidharma said, the words of the Buddha are true, but the three Asamkhya Kalpas refers to the three poisoned states of mind. Within these three poisoned states of mind are countless harmful thoughts, and every thought itself is a kalpa. Such an infinity is what the Buddha meant by the three Asamkhya Kalpas. And so he's really showing, he's presenting how we are to understand practice, how we are to understand everything that we do, beholding the mind, zazen. Which means that when we hear a teaching, we have to engage it in different ways. And we tend to first just engage it on the surface. What do the words mean? How do I understand them? Right? And we come to certain conclusions. And then we need to understand, but what does Buddhism actually mean by this? What does this word mean in Buddhism? What does this concept mean in Buddhism? And how is it understood in an everyday sense, in an ordinary practice sense? And then how is it understood ultimately? So Bodhidharma here is showing us this, that these three infinitely long kalpas are really referring to the various states of afflictions that we live in. And within that arise all of our negative thinking and speaking and acting. And that each thought itself is a kalpa, is infinite in time. And so now what the Buddha is saying is that only after practicing diligently within these infinite moments can we realize liberation. Apart from this mind, there is not a single thing. But what is this mind? And so there are just countless teachings pointing to the nature of this mind. Within our own tradition, there are countless koans that point directly at the nature of this mind. Every koan, every teaching is pointing to the nature of mind. Whether it seems to be directing itself to that directly or not. But we're always looking for markers and signposts. Where are we along the way? How are we doing? You know, it's one of the reasons why not speaking about what happens in face-to-face is important. It's one of the reasons we should be attentive, just conscious, attentive to how we speak about our practice, right? Because words create karma. And so when we're speaking about something very important, particularly something that's very personal, particularly something that is in essence inexpressible, that when we speak about it, as we do and as we must and should, but to do it carefully because something is happening in that moment. Sometimes it's clarification. Sometimes it helps us along the way. Sometimes it's bringing us into contact with somebody, sharing something with a friend within the Dharma. And all of those are important. But it's also doing something in our consciousness, because that's what language does. It leans towards solidification, towards objectification. Now we're talking about something. In the moment we experienced it, that didn't exist. That wasn't happening. Once we begin to talk about it, and the more we talk about it, the more it becomes something else. And so we look for all of these markers. I was thinking about every year when I go to New Zealand in July, it's the same time that the Tour de France is happening. And I stay with a couple of students in their house, and Hone, who's one of the students, is a very avid cyclist. When I'm down there, we go biking together. And he's always torn every year. It's like he never gets over it. The session happens every year at the same time that the Tour de France happens. And every year, it's like a brand new heartbreak, you know? I said, Graham, for Christ's sake, this happens every year. He goes, I know, but it's like... But he tapes all of them. And so when he comes home from session, he's got like hours and hours and hours of obligatory viewing that he has to do. So he always wants me to sit down and watch it with him. So one night I did. And I was thinking about how, you know, as I was watching these incredible athletes, I thought, that's kind of what we would like to happen in practice. You know, we jump onto this machine and we ride our hearts out. And the fans are cheering all along the way. They're holding their hands out and they're cheering and they know our names and they're saying, go on, win, go to the finish line. And every once in a while, somebody rides up and hands us a cold bottle of water. It's amazing. And when in our machine, our posture gets tired, a truck comes up and gives us a new posture, right? Or if it feels a little broken, you know, like you get a flat tire, you just pull over and they give you a new machine. Right? So you feel a little pain, they just give you a new posture. Right? You jump back in and you're back in the race. And then there's the finish line. Oh, yeah. Right? And you cross with hands up. Everybody's on television. The whole world's watching. You're a hero. It's a little bit different than that. Like you don't get that. We don't get that. And I remember moments in my own training where, in my own much more humble ways, I was looking for something like that, right? When I was struggling and, you know, I was feeling very self-pitying and, you know, a little bit of woe is me, I was waiting for one of the monitors to notice and come over and put their arms around me and say, come on, you can do it. You've got what it takes. They were never paying attention at that moment. Beholding the mind is only this moment. It's like, how long does it take us to really understand that there is nothing apart from this? That everything else is fantasy. We think about the past and we think we're thinking about something real. But it's the entire stuff of fantasy. We think about the future and maybe we think we're preparing, we're getting ready. And there is a time for that. But in Zazen, it's just fantasy. Practice is only in this moment. Realization is only in this moment. We practice in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening. We do Zazen. We do liturgy, prostrations, chanting the sutras. We stumble. We pick ourselves up. We give up. We start up again. And what Bodhidharma is saying is every thought, each action is an eternity, is a kalpa, is immeasurable, an infinity. From whose perspective is it an eternity? From the one who does not know. From the one who is not measuring. From the one who is not waiting. And in that eternity, we're released from the tyranny of our concept of time, of our sort of particular insanity of time. In the Dogen fascicle on Being Time, Dogen says, the way the self arrays itself is the form of the entire world. How wonderful. The way the self arrays itself, displays itself, shows itself off, is in the form of the entire world and everything in it. See, each thing in this entire world is one instant of time. And he's not talking theoretically or philosophically or poetically. He's saying, experience this. One thing, one instant, the entire world. He said, here, things do not hinder one another. in this moment, nothing is hindered. The past moment of struggle, the present moment of release, the next moment of struggle are not hindering each other. He says, the way seeking mind arises in this moment only, only and ever. A way seeking moment arises in this mind, nowhere else. It is the same with practice and with attaining the way. And Sesshin in particular is the time to bring ourselves to this. Not to preserve it, but to encounter it, because when we encounter it, we are changed. We're fundamentally changed. In the moment when you're struggling against something, some physical pain, and you're hating it, you're complaining, you're waiting for the period to end, all of that distance making, all of that self appearing in the form of that particular world of unhappiness. And in the next moment when you recall to practice, you call yourself back to practice, and you enter into that pain, you enter into that sensation with nothing held back, there is only that moment. There is no hindrance. At that moment, you are changed. Something has happened that, in a sense, whether, depending on how conscious you are of it, the things are never the same after that moment. I remember the first time I experienced that in Sesshin, here. And I reflected on it afterwards, and I thought, how is that possible? I'm in the same posture, I'm in the same body, and now I'm thinking about it, and here is the pain again. But in those moments, there was no hindrance. And I thought, was that some sort of mind control? Did I somehow sort of, was suppressing the pain? And I reflected on what I was doing. I thought, no, I don't think so. I know what that's like. I know how to do that. That's not what I was doing. And then I began to think about pain as just one moment of sensation, one just particular form of the self arising, a phenomena. And I thought, what is this showing me? I had the sense that I was standing at the threshold of something that was so much bigger than I could understand yet. I felt like I can't really understand this yet. I don't understand all of the magnitude of this, but I had the sense that I was standing at the edge of something large. When we experience, when we realize this mind, realize uncreated eternity. This instant is not produced, not born, and doesn't die, and it is eternity. And in that moment, when there is no hindrance, there is no suffering anywhere. Suffering is seen through the fruit and the flowers, the leaves and the branches. They're all free from birth and death, from suffering and joy. But in that moment, the roots are seen. They don't hinder one another, but they have not yet been cut off. In a sense, there's still sap running through. There's still juice. There's still life to this self, to these attachments, to this delusion. It's not yet actualized. It's not yet fully clear. So Dogen says, flowers fall with our attachments and weeds spring up with our aversion. And he says that after speaking about how we realize the 10,000 things, freeing the bodies and minds of self and other. And that's why we train, right? That's why it's not a practice of just, you know, blowing yourself out and having an experience, being completely enlightened, and then just going home and living your happy, enlightened life, where there is no more obstruction and everything is peaceful. There is training because the roots are not yet cut. The insight is only as deep as it is. And in that way, we both, there is radiance and there is still obstruction. There's liberation and there's still binding. And from a dualistic perspective, it's hard to understand how this could be, because it's like, well, is it true or isn't it? Does it work or doesn't it? This is often how we reduce it, what we reduce it to. True and working means free forever. Right? Which secretly means I don't have to practice anymore. Right? Like that's a problem. And so we train. And we continue training. And the path unfolds. And it never ceases. And so the Buddha continued to practice into his death. All the way through. Which meant actually doing his meditation. Practicing in his walking, practicing in his standing, practicing in his lying down, all the way through his 86 some odd years. This fully enlightened being. Bodhidharma says, the student says to Bodhidharma, but throughout the sutras, the Buddha tells us students that we can achieve enlightenment by performing such meritorious works as building monasteries, casting statues, burning incense, scattering flowers, lighting eternal lamps, practicing all six periods of the day and night, circumambulating stupas, observing fasts, worshiping Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, doing prostrations, all the various practices that exist. And then he says, but if beholding the mind includes all other practices, then such other practices would seem redundant, unnecessary. And this is where we can misunderstand, I think, that if we just meditate, everything else is going to happen. Well, it depends on what do we mean by just meditating, simply beholding the mind. And because in the beginning, we almost certainly will not understand that. We don't, I think, have the capacity to yet understand that. We have various practices. There is an eightfold path. There is an integration, in a sense, a complex system that is deeply, intimately integrated. So integrated that it's unified. That it's not even divisible into separate parts. But we commit that crime, right? We do that transgression so that we can pull out from this inseparable, indivisible whole parts, or what appear as parts, so that we can study this whole that is so vast and so deep that it's hard to even, and impossible to even conceive of, to give us a way in. And so what about all these other practices? And Bodhidharma says, the sutras of the Buddha contain countless metaphors because ordinary beings have shallow minds and don't understand things so deep as the Dharma is, as profound as the Dharma is. The Buddha used the tangible, things that he could point at, things that he could hold up and say, here, what about this? Try this. Do this. Do this with your body. Do this while walking. Do this while sitting. He used the tangible to represent the sublime, to point to help bring out and illuminate that which is not tangible. People who seek blessings, who seek, development, realization, liberation, by relying on external things, external works, instead of internal cultivation, are attempting the impossible. So in other words, when we rely on those different practices, if I just do that, if I just put myself here and sort of get through a week of session, clock in all these hours, right, something's going to happen to me. If I just do a prostration, if I just light a stick of incense and put it in an altar bowl, something's going to happen. And what Bodhidharma is saying, yeah, something's going to happen, but not what you think. Not what you're hoping for, not what you're seeking. And this is the essential teaching, not just of Bodhidharma, but of Buddha Dharma. That it has to be interiorized. It has to be integrated within our whole being. And so, yes, we use what is tangible, orioki, services, altars. We use service positions. For what purpose? To just bring out this self. The self that is calm, the self that is nervous. The self that moves easily along, the self that stumbles. Why? Because it can be seen. Because we have to do that. We have to practice within this body and mind, within our senses, within this mind. That's what we can access, in a sense, in the beginning. You know, the old master Bankei was said that he had one teaching, realize the unborn. That was it. Realize the unborn. True. I wonder how well his students did. That's why there are so many teachings. That's why there are so many ways in. That's why there is training, right? Because it begins where we are beginning. And then as we develop, as we mature, as our realized capacity gets larger, the path gets larger. Or really, the path which has always been large rises up to meet us in the form of various practices and methods and so on, which are not mechanical, they are not machines, and ultimately they are not linear. And so we use images and altars and incense and robes and raksus and precepts and monasteries and shaved heads and all of it. For what Bodhidharma is pointing to is this inner cultivation. This radical inner turning and inner enlivening, awakening. Inner and outer do not hinder each other. One moment, the moment before and the moment after do not obstruct each other. Your delusion does not obstruct your enlightenment. In this moment, your tiredness is not inherently obstructive of anything. When we don't understand that when we empower certain states as having the inherent capacity to stop us, to keep us from practicing, we stop practicing. I mean, why wouldn't we? Why should you keep practicing when you can't? Right? And so we have to see through that and realize, wait a minute. That's just a story I'm telling myself. And all the moments that unexpectedly and seemingly without even our trying, where we see something shift, something intractable, something stuck, something dark, suddenly shifts. That's showing us that there is nothing fixed. There is nothing intractable. But if we don't understand that, we might think, well, I'll just sit and do nothing else. That if I just develop my concentration, that will free me. That if I just see a koan, now I'm realized and everything should be great. If I just have the right kind of experience. And none of these things are being taught in the Dharma. But we can hear them being taught in the Dharma. Because if that's what we're looking for, that's what we'll find. But that's not actually what's being presented to us. The Dharma doesn't come in bits and pieces. And yet, at every step, it is not yet fully integrated, fully realized within the body and mind, all over the body and mind. And so Bodhidharma talks about casting statues, for instance, which is a meritorious practice, to make a Buddha image that people can practice and turn their attention to and do prostrations to and encounter the Dharma, gives you a lot of merit. And what the way Bodhidharma speaks of this is that each aspect of the creation of that is actually just Dharma practice. The body is your body is the furnace. The Dharma is the fire. Your wisdom is your craftsmanship. And the precepts and the paramitas are the mold. And now you smelt and refine your Buddha nature within all of these instruments and pour it into the mold that is formed by your practice, by your sincerity, by your perseverance. And now, acting in accordance with the Buddha's teachings, you create a perfect likeness. And he doesn't mean a likeness in imitation. He means you are Buddha. You are realizing Buddha. Your body is the body of the Buddha. Your chanting of the sutras, the chanting of your understanding of the way things are. That when we burn incense, Bodhidharma says, this doesn't mean just burning ordinary material incense, but the incense of the intangible Dharma, which drives away impurities and delusion. And then he goes on to talk about the different kinds of incense, morality, meditation. He says, light the stick of incense with the fire of your awareness and offer that to the Buddhas. It's not just about sweet-smelling smoke. It's your mind. That being having devotion, reverence, prostrations, is reverence and humility, which means really to revere, to stand in awe of your true self, and to humble your delusions. This form is your real form. He said the Buddha wanted you to think of worship as expressing humility and taming your mind, your unruly, wild mind. And so he told us to prostrate our bodies to show our reverence, to let the external express the internal, to harmonize essence and form, mind and body, understanding and action are unified. So again, if we just rely on just doing a bow mindlessly, absentmindedly, or dividedly, without this understanding, it's not that it doesn't have an effect, because the prostration itself is a subtle gesture. But it is greatly limited, it's made small. It's made outside. Because there's no unifying with the mind. And so all of these practices that we're doing, that on one level can seem as very simple. When you walk, just walk. When you bow, just bow. Right? That you're not turning it into some sort of complicated, theoretical, philosophical thing. Now, in just walking, what is that? To know, you have to enter into it with your whole being. When you bow and you just bow, what is that? And so it means to begin, don't know what walking is. Don't know what a prostration is. Don't bring a Dharma view into it. Let it show you. That's what the Dharma is very generous in that way. All of these forms of practice are very generous. In a certain sense, they're just waiting. for us to show up. In that sense, our Zazen is just waiting for us to enter, to show up, and then it meets us completely and generously. And it's that entering that we have to be diligent and effortful about discovering. What is that? Bodhidharma said, seeing through the mundane and witnessing the profound is less than one eye blink away. Less than an eye blink. In other words, it's not away at all. Realization is now. Why worry about gray hair? He said, but the true door is hidden. It's hidden from ordinary sight. It's hidden from ordinary understanding. It's there, but it won't reveal itself to us. He says, I have only touched upon beholding the mind. And then I say, the rest is in your hands. The rest is in my hands. It's always like this. But to really appreciate that when we think of these, of practice, of training, of these different things, these pieces, these parts, to be attentive to how we make them small in our trying to understand them, to know them. And of course, when one moment is an infinity, when one practice becomes boundless, that's you. That's you that's infinitely large, you that is boundless. Not in some, you know, comic book, you know, romanticized, fantasized kind of way. That's what we have to discover. What is boundlessness? What is limitlessness? And so we have a nice piece of session left. So let's really use it well. It's nice that this session, we begin all together. It's nice when folks join us too, bring in new energy, but it's nice to have been together from the beginning. And so let's not worry about gray hair. Coming, already come, fallen out. Why worry at all, in fact? When we just practice and understand and examine and push deeply into what does that mean? Then we don't need to worry.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.